abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It is Monday, November 25th, 2013, and I want to say a big thank you to all you good folks out there who have been subscribing to the program on iTunes or on Stitcher or using our RSS feed or visiting the archive at TomWoodsRadio.com or listening when we broadcast for the first time at noon Eastern every day at TomWoodsRadio.com. I certainly appreciate this. It warms my heart. And I still get people writing to me saying, hey, I didn't know till just yesterday that you had a program. We've been doing it for 2 months. I'm doing everything I can to get the word out, but I can't reach everybody. So if you guys can help me out, I'd certainly appreciate it. But I'm quite pleased at the audience we have. And I want to thank you guys for that. I also want to thank all you good folks who have been helping us keep the lights on and pay our bills here in our little Tom Woods Show office by entering Amazon at TomWoodsRadio.com. If you enter Amazon through our little Amazon widget at TomWoodsRadio.com, then at no cost to you, you can help us keep our nice little Tom Woods office where I am able to record these programs in peace and quiet. The subject matter for our program today is a bit unusual for the Tom Woods Show, but I have a feeling you're going to find it quite interesting, and it may even, in your own family, be immediately applicable to you. Our guest is Dr. Enrico Nalati, who is the author, most recently, of the book Back to Normal, Why Ordinary Childhood Behavior is Mistaken for ADHD, Bipolar Disorder, and Autism Spectrum Disorder. This book has generated controversy throughout the United States and around the world, so I wanted to have its author here to talk to us about it. Dr. Nalati is a California State licensed psychologist. He specializes in childhood and adolescent therapy and assessment and has more than 25 years of experience providing psychotherapy to children and families, and he has been published throughout the scholarly journals as well. So it's my pleasure right now to welcome to the Tom Woods Show Dr. Enrico Nalati. Dr. Nalati, thanks so much for being here.
It's my pleasure.
Now, I've introduced your book and told people a little bit about it, but let's start off with one of the disorders that's discussed in here. Let's talk about ADHD. Now, you're not one of these people who claims that ADHD is some kind of made-up disorder and it doesn't really exist. It does exist. So can you tell us, first of all, what it is, what a genuine case of it would consist of?
It's a good way to start because, yes, I'm not a romanticist or a polemicist who wants to throw out this diagnosis. I mean, in my estimation, true ADHD has to do with, you know, really dysfunctional levels of impulse control, you know, to wait your turn, being able to follow directions, stay in your area, just stay calm and in your body to the point where you can pay attention for, you know, expectable periods of time in the classroom, for instance. You know, if you're like motorically driven, where you're constantly moving around, constantly on the move, where it's just, you know, disruptive to you and everybody around you. Resulting in real problems in a child's life. In other words, it makes them extraordinarily hard to parent and extraordinarily hard to educate. So that's my kind of everyday language, how I would define ADHD.
Now, we've seen an explosion in the number of cases, as you point out in the book. You say that in a typical American classroom, there are nearly as many diagnosable cases of ADHD as there are of the common cold. So, given that we've seen this extraordinary number of cases, is this, in your judgment, a reflection of the fact that there simply are more people who have ADHD, or is the diagnosis simply just gone completely kablooey here? I mean, are they being overdiagnosed, and why?
I would say that it's being massively overdiagnosed. In the past 10 years, there's been a 41% increase. Actually, a little known statistic that is a very revealing one. In the wake of the No Child Left Behind law, the implementation of it in approximately 2001, within 4 years of that law being passed, there was a 22% increase in the number of cases of ADHD throughout the country. And, you know, partly the reason it's being overdiagnosed, and I would say just parenthetically, it is being overdiagnosed because we know from an NIMH study that 75% of kids who are diagnosed with ADHD no longer meet the criteria by the time they hit their mid-20s. So, you know, ADHD, in my estimation, is you know, it's probably a lifelong debilitating condition that you don't just sort of somehow or other shed in your mid-20s. So now, my argument would be it is a diagnosis that exists, but it's being massively overdiagnosed, partly because of new educational demands being placed on children and the school systems at younger and younger ages, and it's the youngest children on the younger end who are the most vulnerable to being inappropriately diagnosed.
So do you think it's a case of then that the kids are being asked to do things that correspond more to more mature years, and some kids just don't want to do these sorts of things? It doesn't correspond to normal childhood activity, and so the response looks to the superficial observer like ADHD?
I think that's partly true, and I would say, though, Tom, that it's not because kids don't want to do these meet the expectations that are being placed on them, let's say in the classroom. It's because it's sort of developmentally out of reach to them. They
okay.
can't do them. So, in kindergarten, for instance, you're looking at a situation right now where there's one study that I addressed in my book, Back to Normal, that shows that probably upwards of 1 million kindergartners have been inappropriately diagnosed as ADHD just as a function of them being on the younger end of things in the classroom compared to their peers in the classroom and the inappropriateness of the academic demands being placed upon them. And so there's good scientific evidence out there right now to show that, you know, to call attention to this phenomenon.
Now, what are the real dangers of an improper diagnosis? Is there, I mean, okay, so you get the wrong diagnosis. Well, probably people get the wrong diagnosis about a lot of things. What's especially problematic about being improperly named as somebody who is suffering from ADHD? Is it because now you'll be put on a medical regimen that's inappropriate for you? What are the problems?
Well, that's one of them, especially with a diagnosis like ADHD. That oftentimes the diagnosis and the medication are sort of hand in glove. But now one of the downsides to that, or one of the risks to being inappropriately assigned a diagnosis of ADHD, would be that child then has to suffer unpleasant side effects, possibly. And with ADHD meds, more often than not, there are unpleasant side effects. The most robust study that exists out there, the multimodal treatment study on ADHD, it's a long, longitudinal study, the 8-year mark, has found that medicated ADHD children, for instance, are 2 centimeters shorter and 2.7 kilograms lighter than children who are not medicated. So there can be growth issues with these meds. There can be, there's another study I look at in my book, Back to Normal, that shows that ADHD children, medicated ADHD children, get about an hour's less sleep a night on average. So, you know, there's also been heart irregularities associated with these meds. So there's the inappropriate taking of medication and the side effects that go along with that. There's also, you know, with a diagnosis like ADHD, it can, over time, if it's inappropriately applied and everybody in the child's life believes that it's actually an appropriate diagnosis, oftentimes what happens is as children, then there's a self-fulfilling prophecy. They learn to believe that they're incapable of certain things, finishing tasks, being organized, getting places on time, and so on and so forth. They think that they have this, a brain that doesn't allow for those kinds of, that disallows them to take responsibility or disallows them to develop capacities to just sort of, you know, perform and complete everyday childhood tasks. But that's another downside. And then finally, I'll end with this thought. There's a study that shows that about a third of Americans currently think that an ADHD child is a dangerous child. So still in our culture, even though we're very casual and folksy about talking about ADHD, bipolar disorder, and autism spectrum disorder in children, publicly we're very casual and folksy and embracing in the way we kind of talk about it, but privately, any mental disorder that's assigned to children, privately, the average American thinks that that child is a dangerous child just by whatever mental disorder applies. So there's still strong stigmas attached to these disorders in our country, is what I'm getting at.
Right. So it's a difficult burden to carry around with you, especially when, as you say, it can become a self-fulfilling prophecy, and then you're somebody everybody wants to encourage their own kids to avoid, and then it snowballs, I would think. Well, now
there you go.
Now what happens, at one point you talk about childhood narcissism, and you say that this is a phenomenon that can account for some of the symptoms that we see that we associate with or that we wrongly diagnose as ADHD, and it's not. It's this. So what is childhood narcissism for the layman?
That's a good point. And in my book, I really break it down. But okay, take for instance, like there are many kids who are just overconfident, you know, who believe that they should just know things without having to learn them. They have a big belief in themselves and their own ability that doesn't square with reality, and that's a normal, to varying degrees, childhood tendency, I would say, narcissistic tendency. But to the extent that overconfidence is sort of conditioned by the important adults in a child's life, then that could lead to a child sort of, you know, being so overconfident that they underplan, underprepare, underpractice. They just think that they should be capable of achieving certain goals, and so therefore then, of course, their performance breaks down in school. They don't memorize things that need to be memorized, so they become forgetful. They don't rehearse what needs to be rehearsed in their head because they're overconfident, so they become forgetful. And so that would be one narcissistic, normal childhood narcissistic phenomenon that can kind of mimic an ADHD symptom in terms of forgetfulness and kind of academic underachievement. There's also, it's really hard to differentiate, I think, between true hyperactivity and a child just sort of like having narcissistic needs to be in the spotlight, where they're always wanting to call attention to themselves because they're used to getting either too little attention at home, or, you know, like underindulged or overindulged at home, too much attention, so much so that their own childhood narcissistic needs to be heard and seen and appreciate, get acted out in the classroom where they overtalk or they brag, they boast, they may even act out because negative attention is better than no attention at all. For narcissistic reasons, not for ADHD reasons. So these are a couple of kind of narcissistic phenomena that sort of mimic ADHD symptoms. But I really break that down in my book in ways that would help, you know, the average parent or teacher to tease apart what is just childhood narcissism versus evidence of a disorder like ADHD.
Well, that brings up a good question. You do have a chapter specifically for parents here. I mean, the whole book is in some way for parents, but
yeah.
What do you advise a parent to do who gets a diagnosis of, let's say, I mean, you cover several disorders. We'll try and get to the others in a minute, but so a parent gets a diagnosis of ADHD for a child. What's the next step? I mean, is it a second opinion? Is it trying to diagnose the child yourself, which seems kind of difficult? What should the parent do?
First, first, in terms of like trying to figure out if the diagnosis is accurate or not, you know, you and the ambiguity comes into play in the mild cases, and I think that's the problem in our culture right now. It's mild cases that are getting diagnosed more and more, and the line between a mild case of, let's say, ADHD and just a child being a struggling child or a slow to mature child or a child under transitory stress is a really thin line. So I would advise parents to, first off, you know, if a child is ADHD-like at home but not school or at school and not home, then the diagnosis probably doesn't apply. So in other words, it would have to be where these sorts of ADHD-like symptoms are occurring pretty much everywhere in a child's life and getting them into trouble, such that it's making them difficult to parent, difficult to educate. And therefore, if that's the case, then there is not a whole lot of ambiguity. And a parent then can kind of enter the mental health system and the school system thinking that maybe my child does have this thing called ADHD and that I need to be open to the kind of interventions that work with that disorder. But if it's a child who sort of goes through phases, like within one teacher's class, they interrupt, they're squirmy, they get in trouble, they underachieve, they act out, but in a different class, teachers are reporting none of that or very little of that, then we're talking about something other than ADHD. You know, we're maybe talking of, you know, well, then the door opens to kind of all sorts of other childhood phenomena that I address in my book that could better explain these tendencies.
Now, I think when you make these claims about overdiagnosis of ADHD, I think you have a lot of support among the general public. I think the general public often is cynical about the whole phenomenon of ADHD because they feel it's being overdiagnosed. But you, in your book, then go on to talk about bipolar disorder and also autism, where I think people might be less likely to say that there's overdiagnosis going on. So let's take on, you know, where would be the fun in it if we only dealt with the low-hanging fruit here? Let's talk about autism. So again, just for the layman, I mean, we sort of know autism when we see it, but how does a professional know autism?
Well, now that actually is a more difficult question to answer than you would think. I mean, maybe I should talk about autism based on my own experiences and biases. I mean, I see true autism as a serious, debilitating, lifelong neuropsychiatric condition that oftentimes, you know, involves little or no language development, 40 to 70%, depending on the study, of autistic children are mentally retarded. 40% of children with autism have seizures. Serious seizures. There's extreme, bizarre behaviors in terms of repetitive behaviors, spinning around on a seat, needing routines, like scripts and routines for everyone in their life to follow, put to bed with a certain ritual. If you don't follow it to the T, it can lead to massive tantrums. I mean, so we're talking about extreme behaviors. But true autism is something where there's very little ambiguity, and pretty much the professionals, the parents know that it applies. But what has happened right now is it's the mild cases that have inundated the system. Kids who do have language development, kids who may be extraordinarily intelligent in certain areas, but have extreme social difficulties, extreme troubles reading social cues, playing alone, appearing to not have empathetic responses to other kids around them, like they're in their own world and like they're cold and heartless. These types of phenomena are usually associated sort of with the milder cases, but it's very, very difficult to tease apart what is, especially during the toddler years, which is the years where it's most commonly diagnosed these days. It's very difficult, in my estimation, to tease apart what is evidence of mild autism versus what is a difficult toddler, especially a boy? And that's a whole separate topic right there about how boys, in my estimation, are being overdiagnosed and inappropriately diagnosed with mild autism.
Now, if that's the case, where is it coming from? I mean, is it that are the professionals not getting the proper training? Is the training at fault? Like, is what's being taught in the medical schools wrong? Like, where is the error coming in? Like, why is this suddenly happening? Why is there suddenly such a grave amount of error in diagnosis here?
It's a good question, and I think it's complex, the cluster of causes that to explain it, but I think that you just named one of them that right there. That when you look at the education and training of health and mental health professionals, and given that I'm a psychologist myself, it's disconcerting for me to admit this, and it's true certainly of my own education. These days, most health and mental health professionals do not have a background in child development. In what little background they do in child development, it's usually of a textbook sort. The average health and mental health professional doesn't have a good, clear, palpable, concrete sense of how a normal child behaves under stressful circumstances that will allow them to tease apart what is evidence of that versus a mild case of, you know, of ADHD or autism or bipolar disorder. So yes, it has to do with, but believe it or not, there's one study I quote in my book that shows that 40% of pediatricians, and pediatricians are the professional most likely to diagnose ADHD in the country right now, that 40% of them calling themselves pediatricians haven't even done a residency in pediatrics, let alone have a background in pediatric mental health or, for that matter, child development or, you know. So, the education and training of health and mental health professionals is one factor for it. Another factor has to do with just our insurance systems and how they're set up. With cost-cutting, the rationing of care, and the insurance system, it's led to a lot of professionals to maximize coverage, engaging in what's called upcoding. In other words, trying to, if there's a question in terms of whether or not a child meets a diagnosis, they're more and more professionals are assigning them that diagnosis in order to ensure that treatment gets covered. Even though a child may enter the office where they're struggling and they do need help, but they don't really need a diagnosis, if you don't assign them a diagnosis, especially a severe one, the treatment won't be covered. So it's almost like the tail wagging the dog there that we're seeing more and more going on in the system.
Do you get a lot of positive feedback on a thesis like this from people in your profession? And perhaps some of them may want to have their names withheld. They may say to you secretly, yes, I know this is a big problem, but I certainly don't want to go on the record about it. Is there a minority of people out there who professionally who agree with you and who want to see some type of reforms? Or are you a voice in the wilderness?
You know, I think it's mostly mental fellow professionals and colleagues telling me in private that they're not willing to go public themselves. It's, you know, so there's that. But I can tell you the response to my book has been enormous, and mostly from parents and teachers throughout the country and even internationally. I mean, I'm the response to my book has actually been overwhelming and surprising to me. So it makes me think that there's, I've really touched a nerve out there in the country right now, and, you know, in terms of just how out of sorts the system is with respect to overdiagnosing these disorders.
Well, if you say there is an international dimension here, is it nevertheless the case, as far as you know, that this phenomenon of overdiagnosis is nevertheless at its strongest in the United States? I'm just taking a wild guess, yet I have a funny feeling I'm right.
You know, you are right. I actually had a journalist from Ireland called me wanting me to comment on the Irish system, which I know nothing about. But she told me, she said, we have the opposite problem over here where kids who truly do have autism. The parents are, you know, are seeing it as eccentric behavior, or developmentally delayed behavior, or this, that, the next thing, when clearly it's autism. So we have the opposite problem in Ireland that you do in the U.S. So I think you're onto something there, Tom.
Well, how about that? I wish I had some cultural explanation. I'm sure there's a PhD dissertation in there somewhere why this happens in the U.S. But Dr. Nalati, I much appreciate your time. I want to urge everybody to read your book, Back to Normal, to visit your website, which is, in case people don't know how your last name is spelled, GNAULATI.net is your site for more information. Thanks so much for your time today.
It's been a pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
And that will just about do it for the program for today. Tomorrow, my wife will be joining us, and we're going to be talking about how to prepare a delicious, moist turkey with the least exertion possible. There are all kinds of strategies you can use if you have all day long to do it. But why do that when you can do it the easy Woods family way? My wife will reveal her turkey secrets tomorrow, and of course, we'll talk about other things, whatever comes up. Bob Murphy on Wednesday, we're going to be talking about QE and the liquidity trap and the future of the economy and all that good stuff explained for the layman. Nothing on Thanksgiving except enjoying family, but on Friday I'll talk to Phil Giraldi, formerly of the CIA, and I'm going to ask him, does this whole Bin Laden was killed and then we threw him in the water and so there's no real evidence of it, does that seem kind of funny and odd to you? Is there anything a little fishy about that? That and other questions coming up on Friday. Don't forget my LibertyClassroom.com, which is also a sponsor of this program. LibertyClassroom.com is where you can learn the history and economics they didn't teach you in courses you can listen to in your car that are taught by me and by people who are also trustworthy. So check out LibertyClassroom.com as a treat to yourself, using coupon code SHOW in all caps, and you get a discount. All right, thanks, everybody. We're talking turkey tomorrow. See you then.
The Tom Woods Show.